Bigfoot.com. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week at the Republican National Convention in New York, President Bush highlighted a high-concept second-term domestic agenda he calls the ownership society. It is the buzz phrase in the Bush stump speech now, part tax code rewrite, part individual health care savings plan, part personal responsibility for retirement. The ownership society, says George Bush, will shift money and responsibility away from government and back to individual Americans.
In all these proposals, we seek to provide not just a government program, but a path to greater opportunity, more freedom, and more control over your own life.
Republicans call it bold. Democrats call it old, a repackaged conservative agenda that would roll back the social safety nets of the New Deal and Great Society. 2 days after Bush's convention speech in New York, Democratic candidate John Kerry called the president's ownership society the plan of an incumbent dangerously out of touch with the economic hardship already endured by the American middle class.
Parents are sitting at kitchen tables and wondering how they're going to make ends meet and still pay last week's doctor bill, how they're going to make this month's mortgage payment, and whether they're going to be able to save for retirement. If President Bush thinks this is good enough, then he just doesn't get it.
Tonight on Point, George Bush's ownership society, what it is, what it isn't, and what it means for the race for the White House and for you. Question is, are you ready for the ownership society? Does it sound to you like the flexible future or the hard past? Can the country afford the ownership society? Can you? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Richard Dunham, White House correspondent for Businessweek magazine. Richard Dunham, thanks for joining us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
Richard, can you tell us what are the elements of the ownership society to the extent that they've been spelled out by George Bush?
Well, you're right. He has not been specific about it, but we do have a direction. On taxes, it would be to simplify the tax system to tax income only once, which would mean eventually no taxes on dividends, no taxes on capital gains, and no taxes on savings. In terms of retirement, it would be private accounts inside Social Security, so probably a portion of your payroll taxes would go toward accounts that you would have control over, adding risk for the individual, but giving the opportunity for greater return. In terms of health care, it would have, the theory is, more control for the patient in terms of choosing your doctors, in terms of making decisions on what you want to do. There would be medical savings accounts there. The upside is that if you don't have high medical expenses, you could have tax-free money that you could save and would go back to you. The bad news is if you have high medical expenses, you would have a very high deductible. And then in terms of education and jobs, the president is pushing for additional money for job training. He would have individual accounts if people are out of work where they could use it for job training, for transportation, for moving expenses, and keep the extra if they didn't use it all up. But it would do away with a lot of the training programs and the programs we have for displaced workers right now.
So on balance, Richard Dunham, does this leave the American voter, citizen, worker better off or worse off, or can anyone tell?
Well, you can't tell really because we don't have the specifics of all the proposals. Some things the president has sketched out over the years, but the big one, which would be Social Security private accounts, he's not going near the specifics. And in terms of tax reform, I am deducing things from different comments of administration officials. He has not yet made a proposal. He is only at this point pushing simpler and fairer taxes and making his previous tax cuts permanent. But I think it's a what's clear is that it's a philosophical shift away from government as we've known it, and it's an attempt to tie in politically to all of the voters who consider themselves investors, which is a growing group in American society.
Let's hear more about that philosophical shift. We're joined now from Washington by Tim Adams. He's a former chief of staff for Treasury Secretary John Snow. He's now director of policy for Bush-Cheney 04, the reelection team. Tim Adams, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Great, wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Tim, how would you describe, Tim Adams, the philosophical shift, as Richard Dunham puts it, that the ownership society suggests?
Well, I think the view is that for those who choose, we're going to give them greater control and greater choice over how they conduct the affairs of their life. And we believe that any time that individuals are given greater choice and greater control, that they're probably going to make better decisions about their lives than some bureaucrat sitting in Washington.
And in terms of specific elements of this, how much has been spelled out? How much can you spell out? What are the pieces of this?
Well, last Thursday evening, the president gave a speech at the Republican Convention in New York City where he laid out the thematics of the ownership society. We put out a document that is entitled Agenda for America. It's on agendaforamerica.com, in which it goes into some detail on a number of these issues as well as the rest of the president's second-term agenda. But I think your first person there from Business Week, I think, hit most of the high points, and I think also reinforce the theme. Again, it's about control and choice and giving individuals the voluntary ability to have greater control over their lives.
And there's a big question, Tim Adams, about how the country would make the transition. President Bush likes to talk about transformational change, but the transformational transition suggested here would be, it would appear, a costly one. In Social Security, for example, if you have people putting money into private accounts, it's not going to support retirees. And, of course, that's how the system works these days. We've already got an enormous budget deficit. How would this transition be financed if it's to unfold?
Well, the Social Security costs are already there. When the Social Security system was created, we had over 14 workers paying into the system for every retiree. We're now down to about 3 workers paying in for everyone collecting, and we'll soon be down to 2 paying in for everyone collecting. So the long-term demographics of Social Security are not good. We have to strengthen the system. And there are 3 ways to do it. You can raise taxes, you can cut benefits, or you can increase the returns of the system. The president believes that we should protect the benefits for current retirees and near retirees, but give young individuals the opportunity to set aside a small amount of their Social Security savings for their own nest egg, an account that they control, but they can also leave to their heirs.
But if current workers are supporting people who are already retired and then more money is set aside, how would that work? We saw the Congressional Budget Office came out today and said projected a worse-than-expected long-term deficit right now, $2.2 trillion over the next decade. So how do you take money out of that to put into personal accounts, even if you'd very much like to do it?
Well, the president has put in place a 5-year plan to cut the deficit in half by 2009. Certainly that will put the country and the economy on a much stronger financial footing. But the Social Security liabilities are already there. This is not the cost is already there. The transition elements of moving to a personal accounts is like prepaying your mortgage. It's simply recognizing the liabilities that are already there, but recognizing them now rather than in the future.
Richard Dunham, do you see it that way?
You also have to weigh that against the cost of doing nothing, and the status quo is not an option.
Tim Adams, stand by for a second. Richard Dunham, how about it? Do you see it that way? Is it clear how these changes will be paid for, starting with Social Security?
Well, many of the economists expect a transition cost of roughly $1 trillion. They can argue several hundred million dollars one way, billion dollars one way or another. It would have been a lot easier if we had been in a time of great surplus and we could absorb the cost. Tim Adams makes some good points for down the road, but there would be an upfront cost to have the transition to the private accounts, and someone will have to bear it. We'll have to make some choices in spending to figure out how we do it to get the program started.
And Tim Adams, talk to us about where this would all be headed if the country goes down this path. You know that you've got some prominent conservatives, Grover Norquist and others, who would like to see the graduated income tax done away with, who would essentially like to see all the New Deal programs done away with or substantially diminished. Is that the goal of this revolution, as George Bush occasionally puts it?
Absolutely not. There is no interest or intent here to roll back the safety net. Again, we want to make these programs voluntary, not mandatory, but voluntary. And we want to make sure that we maintain and, in fact, strengthen the safety net for those parts of our society that chooses not to make these kinds of choices for themselves, and also those parts of our society that is unable to make those choices for themselves. Again, this is voluntary, and we have no interest in tearing down the safety net.
So how much of the American society then is in a position, do you think, or would be in a position to benefit from this kind of change?
Well, when we say this kind of change, the ownership philosophy encompasses a whole range of different proposals. It could be the portability of health care. It could be greater portability of retirement accounts, of job training, of greater home ownership. We now have the highest rate of home ownership in our nation's history, both overall and also for minority home ownership. The president wants to see home ownership go even higher. So in theory, everyone could participate in some facet of this ownership concept. But again, it's about leaving it to the individual and giving them greater control and greater choice on a voluntary basis.
Tim Adams, are Americans, you know, many of whom are strapped already right now, are they going to be in a position to put money into these programs, into their own health account, into their own personal account within Social Security? Do people have the excess income to set aside for that?
Well, as you know, the payroll taxes for Social Security are mandatory, and they're going to pay it irrespective of whether it goes straight into the U.S. Treasury or whether it goes, or a portion of it goes into their own personal account. We think they should be able to take some of what they're forced to pay and put it into a personal account which they control. But you make a very good point, which is why the president was so adamant in cutting taxes, taxes that put about $2,000 a year into the pockets of the average family of four making $40,000 a year. We understand that people are strapped, but the president is working diligently to get the economy growing at a faster rate and to create more jobs so that people do have the income and can save. But again, this is on a voluntary basis. It's about giving choice and control to Americans.
And Richard Dunham, join us again here for a moment. If it's voluntary, who's likely to dive in to this path if President Bush opens it? Who does this benefit the most?
Well, I think anyone could dive in who wants to, but it's just like tax cuts. The people who benefit the most in terms of absolute dollars are the ones with the most to put into the system. If you have a higher income, you will have more flexibility here. But it doesn't mean that somebody who is middle class or even lower middle class couldn't try to do that and get some benefit that they wouldn't have now. It's just that the people who are wealthier would get more of a benefit from having lower taxes on dividends or lower taxes on interest income.
Tim Adams, when the president spoke on Thursday night in New York, he put this in terms of positioning the country for a new century, not just as individuals, but the entire country. What's the repositioning that the ownership society would do in the GOP's view that would put the country in a better competitive position, a better position for growth in the 21st century?
Well, I think what the president said is that our systems, and I refer to them as systems, our retirement system and our education system, our job training system, were created in a different era, and that era has changed. We now live in a highly competitive global marketplace, and we need systems that allow us to compete in that marketplace. And that may mean that we have greater flexibility, whether it's comp time or flex time in our workplace. But individuals change jobs more frequently, and in many instances, they change careers. So we need health care portability and pension portability so that your pensions and your health care follow you from place to place, and you aren't reliant on the large corporation for your long-term livelihood. The days of the IBM man that you go to work for the same corporation or the same factory and spend 40 years there and then retire there with a gold watch and collect your retirement, those days have gone by the wayside. And that's been a long-term trend. It didn't start 3 years ago, but 30 years ago or 40 years ago. Recognizing these trends, the president wants to anticipate how these trends continue in the future and create new systems that allow people to prosper in a very different kind of global economy.
Tim Adams, we've got it. I know we've got to lose you here, but thanks so much for joining us tonight. Tim Adams, Director of Policy for Bush Cheney 04. Richard Dunham, stand by. There's a lot more we've got to tease out here. Listeners, you can join us. Is America waiting on pins and needles to become the ownership society? Did the New Deal turn the country into something else? Is it really such a nanny state now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Bush's ownership society, what it is, what it isn't, and what it might mean for the country. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you want responsibility for your own health care, your own retirement? Will that work for you? Will it work for the whole country? What does the phrase ownership society mean to you? Does it mean kinder, gentler, more flexible, future-oriented? Does it mean harsh and more vulnerable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Washington by Richard Dunham, White House correspondent for Business Week magazine. We're joined right now from Washington by Gene Sperling. He is chief economic advisor to John Kerry, former economic advisor to Bill Clinton, and head of the National Economic Council from 96 to 2000. Gene Sperling, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So George Bush is talking every time he hits the stump now about the ownership society. What do you understand that to mean, Gene Sperling?
Well, the goal of helping middle-income Americans save more and own a piece of the rock is a certainly worthy goal. The problem is that President Bush's proposals do virtually nothing to promote that. It really is a kind of a classic Trojan horse. You'd use nice rhetoric to kind of hopefully get through the gate, but when you look inside, it's fairly hollow. Let me be very specific in one area.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the heart of their plan is this lifetime savings and retirement savings accounts. Well, if you look at our current system right now, it's already very flawed. Only 5% of Americans already take advantage of the IRAs and 401ks that they have. Only 5%.
5% take full advantage?
Full advantage.
Yeah.
So the question is, what is this doing to help the 95% that aren't taking full advantage? What is this doing to helping the 50% of Americans who have no employer-provided pension, the over 60% of small business employees, the 92% of the working poor, the 70% of Hispanics? The answer is nothing.
So you're saying if they're not maxing out on these opportunities already, they're not in a position to take more advantage of bigger opportunities.
Exactly. So the problem with our current system is that it's upside down. In other words, if you're well off, you already, when you deduct a dollar for health for a pension, you already get 35 cents on the dollar because it's deductible. So if you're in the 35% rate, we give people the greatest tax incentives who are in the highest income brackets. In addition, those people often have what I'm fortunate enough to have, which is a matching 401k, where when you put in a dollar, your employer matches it. That's terrific. We should have a goal to try to give more and more Americans the opportunity to save. But what George Bush is doing is looking out and he's saying, well, what can I do more to help the 5% who are already maxing out on savings, who are already using the most? His plan does nothing for the bottom 95%. So to suggest that this is somehow helping middle-income families save more for the future is just simply not true. And it's very interesting that one of his top supporters, one of the top Republican supporters of pension access in the Congress, Rob Portman from Ohio, has called the lifetime savings account a mistake. And one of the reasons they could never propose it was that he did not even support it. And what's sad is that this is so consistent with the president's overall economic strategy, which is not to help middle-income people do better, not to help middle-income people gain new wealth, but to lower the taxes on those who are already fortunate enough to have wealth. If you have zero dividends, which they tried to do, zero on the estate tax, zero capital gains, and now there's new accounts where people who are well off can put money and see it compound easily. That's just going to lead to a more divided society. What we should be doing are the kind of things Senator Kerry's trying to do, which is to say, what do people want to save for? College education. Mm-hmm. He's got a four-year college tuition tax credit. That is helping Americans, and one of the things they save the most for, which is college education. These are the type of things that would help families get by, have more money, have a chance to put aside some money. One of the only good things, and it's a small good thing, but it's called the Savers Credit, and it helped. It was something we proposed at the end of the Clinton administration. It got into the 2001 bill. It's not much, but at least it's something. At least it helps lower-income people save more. It's one of the few tax cuts which this this administration hasn't proposed. So it all sounds good, but when you look at the fine print, if you're a middle-income family, if you're one of the 95% who isn't saving, already taking advantage of your IRA or 401k opportunities, and you ask, what's in this for me? The answer is pretty much nothing.
Well, there's a very loud counterview from John Kerry's chief economic advisor, Gene Sperling. Gene, stand by. Callers want to join us. Don is calling from Wanakee, Wisconsin. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
How are you doing this evening?
Great, thanks.
I've been on the Social Security issue for about a decade now, and I'm fighting for my kids and grandkids. Let me just throw a couple of numbers out here. Since 1985, we've collected about $814 billion more in cash than has been required to pay us retirees. I'm 71.
Okay.
Between now and the year 2017, which is the last year there will be more collected than is paid out, it will grow to $1.9 trillion. Now, here's what bugs me. If I've got a son and daughter-in-law that are making $87,900, that's the limit this year, and I look at somebody that's making $10 million pre-tax profit, that gentleman would normally pay about 440 times more than my son and daughter-in-law. But because all of these extra dollars, and by the way, there's just IOUs in there, they're worthless. Because of the using of all of these extra dollars through payroll tax, they pay the same amount of this $1.9 trillion instead of the very rich, and of course, $10 million is peanuts.
Don, let me ask you, let me cut through this right to this ownership society front and the personal retirement accounts. Are you for it or against it?
I'm definitely for it.
And why?
Because even the welfare state of Sweden realized they had to go to it, but at a very late date. And the more we delay, the bigger the problem is, because we not only increase the debt because the law forces them to spend the money, then there's an interest calculation on top of it. So we're going to be, and this is why I respect my former Democrat, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. There's nobody in the Democratic Party that understood the problem better than him. I wish he were still alive.
Don, we've got it. Gene Sperling, let me put that to you, Gene. There's a concerned father, perhaps a grandfather, saying it's not going to be around if we don't do something different.
Well, I think his concern's right. I disagree with his remedy. I mean, the concern for Social Security is that we should be saving more now as a country. We want to save more now for two reasons for Social Security. One is that by saving more, we'll be more productive, better off, better able to have a fewer number of workers support the retirement of a larger number as we hit the baby boom retirement. And secondly, we don't want our Social Security fix to happen by just passing on higher debt or higher taxes to our children. So what should we be doing? We should be saving more as a country. That's what President Clinton was doing when he talked about saving the surplus for Social Security, saving that Social Security surplus that the gentleman was talking about. Let's look at what George Bush has done. He has essentially depleted savings that could have been for paying down the deficit, for helping us save more. And what for? For a middle-class tax cut, that may be a good reason. For Homeland Security, that's certainly a good reason. But he also gave a tax cut to the most fortunate, the top 1%, those making over $200,000. One of the most stunning statistics that exist right now is that we could completely save Social Security for the next 75 years if we simply use the money that's gone to the top 1% in tax cuts. Let me repeat that. If we, instead of having cut taxes so dramatically for the top 1%, had used that money for Social Security, we could keep Social Security solvent for the next 75 years. That is a huge choice to have dramatic consumption increases for the top 1% at the expense of either dramatic cuts in Social Security or higher debt for our children in the future. That was a choice President Bush made, and it's a choice I'm afraid our country may pay for years, even generations to come.
Richard Dunham, how do you hear this? We've had Tim Adams, the GOP guy, now Gene Sperling is with us with John Kerry. Very different views of this shift that President Bush is talking about. How do the two views add up to you, Richard?
Well, to me, I think it's healthy to have a serious discussion of these issues and Social Security in particular. There is, and we need to do something. I mean, it's a very few people who say that we need to do nothing, but all the choices have consequences. And yes, if the president's proposals, broadly stated, would become law, people would have a chance to have a greater return, but there are trade-offs. I mean, you can't take that money out of Social Security that you would give the percentage of the payroll taxes that they invest without having some sort of a reduction long-term in the guaranteed benefits, sort of the safety net Social Security they would get. The president says that he would guarantee for all retirees that they could opt out of this partial privatization and keep their benefits. But again, when you're taking that much money out of Social Security to give the private accounts, you have to have trade-offs. And I think this is a really good discussion. I'm not going to say that either side is correct, but the public should be able to hear it intelligently on both sides and then make a decision.
Well, let's keep it going. Richard Dunham, Gene Sperling, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, William Beach. He's Senior Fellow in Economics and Director of the Center for Data Analysis at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. William Beach, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure, Mr. Ashbrook.
So Gene Sperling, Chief Economic Advisor to John Kerry, is with us, and he has just described the Ownership Society overall as in his view, yet another way of pushing resources toward those who already have a lot of resources, toward the rich. How do you see it, William Beach?
I really appreciate Gene's point of view. He's certainly a strong advocate for that point of view, and I've heard him speak on this subject a lot of times. I make my living, Mr. Ashbrook, with a green eye shade on, and for once I want just take that off and back us up just a moment and talk about what this might mean. I kind of think what Larry Summers says about the rental car is a very good phrase. He said that you hardly ever see anybody washing a rental car. What that means is that ownership and a sense of ownership or a sense of propriety of being a part of a system brings to a person something special. And they buy in, and their behaviors change.
But don't Americans own an awful lot of things already, William Beach? Isn't this an ownership society today, as we talk tonight?
But what we're addressing this to, what we're really focusing on, are low and moderate income Americans who have not, for generation after generation, you know, the cycles of intergenerational poverty, have not had that chance to really get a piece of the rock. And yet we know in other countries that have, for example, taken the road of a personal retirement account system to make their own systems of social insurance more secure, that there is not only an increase in savings in low and moderate income households, but there is an increase in education and knowledge about markets, equity markets, and bond markets. There's a change in behavior that goes well beyond savings, goes to the length of time that people will work, the sense of ownership they have over themselves. You see behavioral changes occur.
What countries are you talking about, Bill
Beach? You can begin with England and go into Chile. You can go into the central reaches of Asia and look at what's happening in Mongolia. There are cases in countries that we recognize are similar to ours. Australia, Sweden was mentioned a little bit ago. In country after country, changes are being made, some more successfully than others. But in each case, what you see is a transformation in the knowledge about markets, the knowledge about money, the knowledge about what people can do to change and affect their lives when these options are made possible. Now, Gene has mentioned that there's going to be another giveaway to the rich, but he misses the entire focus of the ownership society. Wealthy people, people with incomes above $100,000, for example, in a household, have the ability to control their health destinies much more than what people below that do. Or they have educational choices that they can make, and they have had those choices whether taxes have been high or low over the course of the post-World War II period. Retirement, they're largely not going to be reliant on Social Security. They have personal savings and investments and savings in general. There's a savings ethic in households that are above $100,000, which is quite different than below. So the focus is not on those people. The focus is on the people who have not had the chances that the rest of us have had. You know, I used to walk in the backwoods of the Ozarks when I worked for the state of Missouri, looking for people who were eligible for the WIC program. And I can assure you, Mr. Ashbrook, those people had no idea that they could save for their own retirement or health care. It was an amazing difference from the rest of not only Missouri but the country.
Gene Sperling, jump in here. William
really,
Beach is describing
really
a different world.
I really do need to jump in. But first of all, the professor's saying a lot of things about the concept of ownership that I agree with. I strongly believe we should be helping change our system so that there are people who are in the middle class have greater incentives to save, that our tax system and our incentive system gives them some of the same incentives that those who are more fortunate are able to. But he completely is passing over a few very fundamental points. Number one, a lot of people aren't saving right now because they don't have any money. It's not that they don't have the savings ethic. They're living paycheck by paycheck. Part of the reason they're living paycheck by paycheck is because in the last 4 years, George Bush has done nothing to deal with the spiraling health care costs. It's been up 49%. We're going more into debt, both in personal families and as our country. Tuition's gone up 35%. So one, if you want to help people save more, you have to deal with some of the pocketbook issues. And we've seen incomes down 1,500. These together overwhelm the amount of tax cuts that people's received. Secondly, he's not addressing the fact that these initiatives President Bush is proposing simply just don't deliver. They do not help middle-income families save. Now, Social Security, I mean, I have to say, this is very close to false advertising. You would get the impression that you're given some costless new account that you get to save and get your new earnings. Here's what they don't tell you. It would cost nearly $2 trillion to fund these new initiatives. Two, that Congressional Budget Office has shown that the benefits could be cut by 23 to 45%, even including the new individual accounts. The plan President Bush has actually gives people very little control. The money would accumulate an account, and then they call a clawback of 80 or a tax of 80% takes the money out. So, yes, this privatizes Social Security. Yes, it puts people, it subjects them more to risk. But does it actually give middle-income, lower-income people an additional incentive to save? Does it give them more funds to save? Does it turn our upside-down savings system right side up? It does none of these things. So we can all agree on the rhetoric is nice, and we can all agree we should do more to help middle-income people save, and that people are more likely to take greater care of things they own, and that we should try to help all Americans gain wealth. The fact is, President Bush's proposals do virtually nothing to help middle-income families.
William Beach,
overwhelmingly to upper income. So, you know, if we had a plan that fit the rhetoric, that would be one thing. But, you know, look at this.
Gene Sperling, hang on for a second. We're coming to a break, and I want William Beach to jump in here. William Beach, is there the money there for the middle and lower class to actually put toward these opportunities, even if they're opened?
Well, we would start with the payroll taxes. What Gene says is right. Low-income people are low-income because they generally have not saved and developed those kinds of cash assets.
He's saying they don't have the income to save.
Well, but they pay taxes. If they're working, they pay taxes. And we would start with maybe 2 to 3 percentage points of their payroll tax. And that's what gets started, Mr. Ashbrook, when they begin to save even taxes they pay. And there's an account there that isn't transitory and illusory like the current Social Security Trust Fund accounts. Then that sense of ownership takes over. I would remind Gene that the system of Social Security has saved people from getting into poverty for a long, long time. It's a very fine system. It's very successful. But intergenerational poverty continues, and I think it's time for us to face up to that fact. And actually, I'm delighted by the fact that Gene has said the rhetoric is very nice, and now we just need a plan. Remember that President Bush has not actually proposed a plan yet.
We've got to hold it right there. We'll be back just after a break. William Beach, Gene Sperling, Richard Dunham, we're talking tonight about George Bush's ownership society. Is this just a marketing slogan, or is there a revolution in the works here? What is the revolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Bush's ownership society, what it is, what it isn't, what it might mean for the country. You can join the conversation. Does calling America an ownership society make the interests of the poor, the middle class, and the rich all the same? Is this just another way of favoring the rich, or is it the path to opening up opportunity for all? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Besha's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Besha, you're on the air.
Hi. just wanted to make the point that nobody that I know that needs health insurance, that is living without health insurance, has any extra money to put in any savings accounts. And I think that that point has been made. And I heard the discussion about, you know, getting tax back. My family got all their taxes back last year, where as middle class as is left in America, I think, right now. And, you know, that money would not have covered anywhere near my family's health costs from last year. Everybody that I know who has no health insurance owes thousands to hospitals for having to go to emergency rooms when they couldn't be seen anywhere else. And those kinds of, I just don't think that President Bush or any of his advisors or anybody he knows anyone who is in this kind of situation. It's something that is beyond him. He only knows rich people.
Besha, we've got it. It doesn't sound like a working formula to you. Richard Dunham, let me just put this to you. Can you clarify, what would it actually mean, ownership society policy on health care accounts? And I've got to, every family would pay for their own health insurance? Employers would no longer be involved, or what?
No, the main thing is that it would let families set up the tax-advantaged nest eggs for out-of-pocket medical costs. It would not eliminate our system, but in theory it would attempt to help the growing number of people who work for small businesses cover medical costs who today are uninsured. Also, it presumes that we're moving toward a society where the medical costs get greater and greater, and the only way to guarantee that big companies don't drop people would be to have this as a backup.
This kind of a subsidy to what the companies pay now for employees, you're saying?
Right. Well, this would be an option, but it would not be. I mean, this envisions a different world where most jobs are not from major corporations, but through smaller businesses. And it really envisions its own kind of world, and we'll find out in a decade or two if we're headed that way. And in a way, all of this is a social engineering of the right, which is maybe a mirror of the welfare system, a social engineering of the left in the 1960s.
A mirror as in the opposite.
Right, exactly. And, the best way to improve the state of the poor and the working class would be through this as opposed to through a welfare system. And, again, they both have costs, and we don't know what the unintended consequences are. Gene Sperling mentions one, which is the same benefits would be available to wealthier people, and they would have a whole lot more dollars that would come to them through this system, whereas the welfare system didn't do that. It was just benefits to the low end.
But we really are talking in that case about a transformation, even a revolution. I want to try and get a couple more calls in here. Ray is calling from New York City. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you?
Fine. Thanks, Ray.
I have so many objections to this conversation that I almost do not know where to begin.
Well, jump in.
I will start with the primary objection, which is clearest. The last thing that most Americans want with respect to health is choice. They want security. And security is not supplied in the marketplace. The marketplace is virtuous for a lot of different things, like innovation and resource allocation efficiency, but it's not a virtue with respect to the quest for security.
You're afraid of being left out in the cold on the healthcare front.
What?
You're afraid of being left out in the cold on the healthcare front.
I think there are two parts of this. Not only I'm afraid to be left out in the cold, but health is an incomprehensible problem for large numbers of people. They don't understand what their health is. They can't predict their health, and it's impossible for them to essentially make a bet on whether I'm going to have a heart attack or I'm going to need lifetime care or I'm going to have a lot of little minor things that I'll need assistance on.
Ray, I know you've got a lot on your plate, but let us pick that one up because it's a big, strong one. William Beach, how would one begin to save for the kinds of eventualities we all know you can come up against in healthcare that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars? You know, Ray is listening in New York and saying, this just sounds like something that's going to leave people like me, possibly, out in the cold. I'd rather have security than all this choice. I'd rather know that I can have healthcare.
When we talk about healthcare, we really do begin from security.
Everyone who has a health care crisis, and it often occurs in the last years of life, is not in a position at that point to be talking about choice. And I don't think that's what the president has in mind at all. In fact, it's pretty vague right now as to how this plan would eventually come out.
Okay.
Discussion has to start. But health savings accounts, savings for health outcomes that can be made when I'm young and can be continued as I'm healthy and working and when I'm reaching my prime years, are meant to supplement, to complement, to fill in the holes, to put extra money there for a couple of reasons, one of which is to handle the health problems of old age and emergencies that happen during working life. But here's another one that I think is so important, and it goes back to security. If you're a person in your prime working years, your greatest fear is that you'll lose your job and you'll lose your health care as a consequence. And that's because we did a very silly thing during World War II, and we tied health care to the place of work, and we've continued uninterrupted since that time. That's a reality. We have to work with that. We have to live with it. But if you had dedicated funds, not much, maybe 10,000, maybe 50,000 over a course of life of working, which were devoted to the possibility that you might need them for health care, you might not fear as much losing that job. Now, I think the first step in health care reform is to break begin to break the axis between the place of work and the provision of health care. Portability is absolutely essential to work our way out of this mess. But let's get real. The health savings accounts are meant to do minor things at this point, to do the sort of confidence-building steps that people need. I think Ray is exactly right. We need to focus on security and how we can deliver that to the healthcare system.
Gene Sperling, I'm going to get your answer to that, but I want to get one more call here first. Jim is calling from Detroit. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because, and Mr. Sperling, with all due respect, sir, when you talk about a $50,000 health care plan over the course of someone's life, we know that self-insured plans have been decimated by companies that have had them and employees paying into them in one incident, well over the $50,000 mark. And then to say that you're going to help provide that security, I don't see it. As
I think you're speaking to William Beach there, Jim, but how about the overall impulse here to have Americans save more of their own resources to deploy them as they choose?
I think if we had a leader who looked at saving more of our funds that we have as a nation, you drive people to save their incomes as opposed to this spending spree that we've been on. When we talk about enlargement of the government, we're spending more in Iraq in 1 month than we have put in national homeland security for the whole program.
Jim, we've got it. With that, I've got to let you go. Our time is almost out. Gene Sperling, a final word goes to you here. You hear the concerns the callers are raising. You hear William Beach's reply. What's yours?
Let's go back to the woman who called in. Here's a woman who's working. She has no health care and debt. Does she want to save? Does she want to have ownership? Of course she does. But right now she doesn't even have health care and debt. So if you want to help that woman, if you want a real plan for ownership, the first thing you need to do is have a plan like Senator Kerry does that gives 27 million more Americans health care that lowers costs. Then you get a start. Then maybe if you can help somebody like that, then you can talk about whether or not we can give them incentives to help them save. George Bush is looking out at the savings world and seeing 5% of people with cake and proposing icing. That woman needs savings. She needs health care. Telling her that if she had a lot of money, she could buy health care. If she had a lot of money, she could get a small deduction for savings really doesn't help create the kind of ownership society we'd like. That's why this really is just a Trojan horse. And I don't think anything any of us say speaks as well as the real situation that woman just told about her life.
Well, with that, we are out of time, but we can clearly feel the kind of pivot point we're on here with one direction or another outlined in this conversation. Fascinating. Gene Sperling, Chief Economic Advisor to John Kerry, thank you so much for being with us tonight. And William Beach, Senior Fellow in Economics and Director of the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard Dunham, White House Correspondent for Business Week, wonderful to have you along. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Very welcome.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, sounds from the campaign trail as George Bush and John Kerry take their messages to Midwestern swing states. This is On Point. George Bush and John Kerry continued their post-Labor Day sprint through the swing states today. The president spoke in Lee's Summit and Sedalia, Missouri, while Senator Kerry visited Greensboro, North Carolina, and Cincinnati, Ohio. As the campaign enters its final weeks, On Point will be bringing you sounds from the stump as the two candidates work to rally the electorate. We begin tonight with John Kerry upping his rhetoric against Bush in Cleveland, Ohio, over the weekend.
The choice in this election is very straightforward. We're talking about whether or not you're going to rehire the top dog. We're talking about whether or not the person at the top has done the job that merits being rehired. And I say to you, if you want 4 more years of loss of jobs overseas, 4 more years of kids being left behind, 4 more years of the deficits growing in this country, 4 more years of the loss of respect for our great nation, then you should go out and vote for George Bush. But if you want an America where we bring people together, an America where we have Social Security for the future, where we create jobs for people that pay more, if you want an America that lifts people up, doesn't tear them down, we want you to join John Edwards and John Kerry to change the future. I want you to know that at that convention last week in New York City, the Bush administration actually told America that outsourcing jobs is good for our nation. But that doesn't surprise you. That's what they've been doing for the last 4 years, right? So that's what they intend to do for the next 4 years. Now, I'll tell you what. That's W. Wrong decision, wrong direction, wrong choice for America. And we need a president who's going to move America in the right direction.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry speaking yesterday in Cleveland. George Bush has spent most of the last couple of days in the swing state of Missouri, spelling out his economic plan. Here he addresses a crowd in Poplar Bluff, Missouri.
In a changing world, America must be the best place in the world to do business. That means we got to stop these junk lawsuits that are hounding our small business owners in America. It means we got to reduce the regulations on those who employ people. To create jobs in America, we need an energy plan. Listen, I submitted one to the Congress over 2 years ago. It's a plan that encourages conservation. It's a plan that encourages the use of renewable sources of energy like ethanol and biodiesel. It's a plan that encourages clean coal technology. It's a plan that encourages environmentally sensitive exploration for natural gas. But it's a plan that says if we expect to keep jobs in America, we must be less dependent on foreign sources of energy. We're going to keep opening up markets. Listen, this farm economy is strong. You might remember what it was like in 2000. Now, look, I understand the farm economy is never strong enough. And the weather is never good enough. Price of beans and corn is pretty high. And one reason it's high is because I made a pledge to our farmers here in Missouri and around the country that I would do my best to open up markets. We want you feeding not only the American citizens, we want you feeding everybody around the world.
President Bush speaking to supporters in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and John Kerry addressing a crowd in Cleveland, Ohio. On Point will continue to bring you candidate speeches from the campaign trail in the weeks ahead. Join us for them. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.